The Guardian Network. Gentlemen, and welcome to the Political Review for this, the 19th day of February, year of our Lord, 2023. It is almost impossible to believe that we are already more than halfway through the second month of the year in 2023. As I've been saying on the show for the last couple of months, time just seems to have kicked itself into overdrive, and we've accelerated, and I hope that you are using this time wisely.
Exactly.
You are spending your time with the people that you love, doing things that are important, and with that, we got a long show today. I got important matters to attend to, so let's just dive right in. First up in the political review this week, I wanted to start here because I think it's a bit of something to smile about or something to think deeply about, depending on your perspective. But political hopeful Lincoln Bain, once again charged in court this week with unlawful assembly on Friday of this past week after protesting out of Bahamar ahead of the CARICOM meeting this last Wednesday. This is, at the same time, Bain is facing separate charges in the magistrate's court for unlawful assembly again in connection with his protest outside Parliament Square last October. That demonstration was held in connection or in response to the country's quote-unquote immigration crisis. Bain is the leader of the Coalition of Independence, and he appeared this week along with 17 other defendants before Senior Magistrate Carolyn Vogt Evans. They all pled not guilty. The press coverage of the matter has been quite extensive, so we don't even need to spend too much more time on it. But I just I did want to point out that it was a major feature of the week in politics, and I'd be very curious to hear from our listeners what they feel the arrest itself and the charging of Mr. Bain will accomplish. Next up in this week's political review, we will take a look at some of the top stories that came out of the CARICOM meeting. Now, we start with Canadian Premier Justin Trudeau, who was a special guest at the CARICOM Heads of Government meeting, and who pledged to deploy Royal Canadian Navy vessels to Haiti in the face of political and social unrest in that country. Trudeau reported that Canada has provided direct support to bolster the Haitian National Police so that Haiti has the tools and support to solve the ongoing situation, including deploying surveillance aircraft and vital strategic security equipment and vehicles, and additional delivery with an additional delivery of vehicles in the coming days. He added that Canada will now deploy the Navy vessels to conduct surveillance, gather intelligence, and maintain a maritime presence off the Haitian coast. Trudeau was asked at a press conference later in the day how the ships would be used to stop what is essentially an urban gang combat and whether they would be used to intercept migrants. And it's important for us in the Bahamas, dealing with what we're dealing with, to understand and appreciate Trudeau's response. He said that the Canadian ships will not be there to intercept migrants, but will be used to assist the Haitian National Police in their efforts to control gang activity. So these ships will be useful in hopefully helping the gang violence that is wreaking havoc in Haiti right now, which will have a knock-on effect, we hope, of reducing an outflow of illegal migration. But that is not the purpose to which these vessels are being used. And I think it's very important that we appreciate that and understand that that is the reality of what's going on here. Yes, the Canadian vessels are going to be important for Haiti, but I don't think that we can rely on them or count on them to do much to assist us with the migration challenges that we have. Trudeau also announced $10 million to support the international organization to strengthen the protection and resilience of Haitian women and children, and said that Canada would invest another $12.3 million in humanitarian assistance. Of course, you know, we in the Bahamas have been among the regional nations most impacted by the Haitian crisis, with large numbers of undocumented migrants pouring into our waters on unseaworthy vessels. Last month, Immigration Minister Keith Bellow said that the Bahamas had recorded the largest number of repatriations of illegal migrants in a, quote, very, very long time in 2022, with the vast majority being Haitians. And at the opening of the CARICOM meeting on Wednesday evening, Prime Minister Philip Davis noted that the Bahamas is under great strain, as are many other countries in the region who are also heavily impacted. Meanwhile, Trudeau also pledged $44.8 million in new funding to tackle the climate crisis in the Caribbean. He said the money would support projects with regional organizations like the Caribbean Community's Climate Change Center, the Caribbean Bank that would improve marine and coastal ecosystem management. The money would help increase water security and help governments better respond to the impacts of climate change and natural disasters. Trudeau acknowledged that one of the significant challenges facing CARICOM countries in dealing with climate change is accessing climate and concessional financing. Along with the crisis in Haiti, of course, climate change was among the issues prominently featured at that meeting. And when we get to our top story for today's show, we'll go a little more in depth on that. But before that, also coming out of the CARICOM meeting this week, Dame Janet Bostwick accepted the prestigious CARICOM Triennial Award. Dame Janet declared that the battle for full gender equality is far from over in our region and urged stronger focus on women's rights throughout the CARICOM. Dame Janet, an attorney who in 1982 became the first woman elected to the House of Assembly in the Bahamas and was recognized regionally as a trailblazer in the fight for the protection of women and girls, said that while we do not in any way discount the rights of all persons to pursue those objectives that are specifically important and relevant to them and the choices which they make, we must be careful not to be distracted from the cause of the rights of women. She said the issue had been relegated to a position of lesser importance and is being choked out by the clamor of others, which, in her word, is tragic. In 2021, Dan Janet emerged as the winner of the 2021 award out of 13 distinguished CARICOM women. She's the 13th recipient of the award, and which recognizes the sterling contributions of distinguished Caribbean women to socioeconomic development. And our next big story in this week's political review comes from the ongoing FTX saga with Peter Greaves, one of the court-appointed joint provisional liquidators overseeing the cryptocurrency exchange FTX Digital Market. The joint provisional liquidators are exploring the possible resuscitation of the FTX trading platform. This week, U.S. bankruptcy judge John Dorsey granted the JPL's request for Chapter 15 bankruptcy recognition. That allows U.S. and foreign bankruptcy courts to collaborate when assets are spread over multiple jurisdictions. In a statement on the decision, Greaves said, quote, "This is an important step in the provisional liquidation of FTX Digital, and which follows the recognition of the cooperation agreement with the U.S. debtors in both Supreme Court of the Bahamas and the Delaware Bankruptcy Court. The JPL's hope now to be in a position to work through the various roadblocks that have put full control of FTX Digital's assets and information." Greaves said that the JPLs are working hard to identify and gather in assets of FTX Digital, also to explore the possible resuscitation of the FTX trading platform, and where appropriate, commence recovery actions for the benefit of the customers and creditors of FTX Digital. He said investigations have uncovered more than $5.6 billion in transfers from custodial accounts to FTX Trading Limited, which is another company in the FTX group, alongside $2.1 billion transferred to FTX affiliate Alameda Research. And following Sam Bankman-Fried, with co-mingling funds between FTX and his hedge fund, Alameda Research, the exchange fell apart last November. FTX Digital Markets Limited is a company incorporated in the Bahamas and operated as a digital assets business under the Digital Assets and Registered Exchanges Act 2020, or the DARE Act. Following FTX's implosion, the Securities Commission of the Bahamas moved to have the company put into liquidation in the Bahamas. With this new move and the recognition of Chapter 15 bankruptcy, the JPLs here in the Bahamas hope to determine whether efforts to monetize FTX's international platform and or platform are feasible with the cooperation of the Chapter 11 debtors or otherwise. Next up in the political review for this week, while the recent decision of Supreme Court Justice Sherrill Grant Thompson to lift the injunction she had granted in 2018 preventing the government from demolishing shanty towns has some now calling on the Davis administration to bring in the bulldozers, the fact is there are complex considerations that must be deliberated before any action is taken. This is an important story. It's one that we've been following closely here on the political review. So we're going to take a deep dive now into the backstory and the context. With illegal migration and the presence of shanty towns on New Providence, Abaco, Eleuthera, and other islands currently topping the list of concerns held by many Bahamians, the government is facing pressure in some quarters to strengthen its response. In May 2021, after United Nations human rights experts stated that the planned forced evictions and demolitions constituted a serious violation of the human right to adequate housing and would result in arbitrary internal displacement, then opposition leader Philip Davis said the matter must be addressed in a humane manner. In discharging the 2018, Grant Thompson said that any action taken in relation to shanty towns, quote, should be humane and sensitive to the needs of this potentially vulnerable community, and in full compliance with the international conventions, such as the United Nations Convention on Human Rights, the Interim Rights, which recognizes the inherent dignity of equal and unalienable rights of all members of the human family, unquote. After Grant Thompson's ruling, Davis, now Prime Minister, answered questions from is prepared to now address the issue of shantytown. I'm going to pause for a moment here, and I want you, ladies and gentlemen, who are listening, to stick a pin. Having been released by the courts to move ahead, the Prime Minister has committed that his administration is now prepared to address the issue of shantytowns. What that means is that in the coming weeks, months, we as a community should see a definitive, directed policy, sustainable campaign to deal with the shantytown issue. And there is no excuse anymore of saying, well, the courts say we can't do anything. So now that the courts have released the shackles, it's up to the Davis administration to show us how they intend to deal with this incredibly vexing issue. Back to the story, former Minister of Labor Dion Folks, who headed the ministry administration's Shantytown Action Task Force, noted that while he was reacting to the recent court decision, that a focus of that task force had been to identify locals for individuals with status in the Bahamas who lived in shantytowns. But the court action taken by a group of 177 shantytown residents, represented at the time by Fred Smith, King's counsel, and the subsequent granting of the injunction had halted the work. While minutes of the SATF showed that the task force was cognizant of the requirement for alternative housing upon policy implementation, the Minnesota administration adopted the position that, quote, by no means subsidizing living spaces for the residents, as it would cause unrest among Bahamian communities who were still awaiting assistance from the government, unquote. Among the subcommittees of the Shantytown Action Task Force was an alternative housing group, which focused alternative housing for residents of shantytown. Grant, a little important, so I need you to listen to this and pay close attention. Grant Thompson found that the policy decisions and related actions, in her view, were sensitive to the plight of the relevant population, in particular, making decisions in a manner so as to minimally affect schooling of the children in affected areas and locating or providing alternative housing for the affected community within the limits of available resources. The judge stated that she is satisfied that the minister has the remove or the or require the removal of dangerous or dilapidated buildings, even to the point of demolishing them. Such structures would obviously pose a risk to the health and safety of the public, she observed. Just how aggressive the Davis administration intends to be in the execution of its own policy on shantytowns, which, by the way, we don't know, is currently not known. So number one, we don't know what the government's policy on shantytowns is. Number two, we don't know how aggressive the administration intends to be in executing that policy. Number three, we don't really have any against which to measure progress. In October, Minister of Works Alfred Sears said it was time for action to address the expansion of shantytowns, particularly in Abaco. In December, Sears said that the government was expanding its survey of shantytowns after it determines the next steps, including possible deportation of some residents, to address the longstanding issue of irregular communities in the Bahamas. But keep in mind, And a part of the work of the Shantytown Action Force in 2018 was to conduct a survey of Shantytown. Now, of course, that was 5 years ago, and thus the information from that survey is likely no longer accurate. And so the task force conducted a survey of 10 shantytowns on New Providence over a four-week period. So it was limited to this one island. But even then, the results revealed that there were 1,410 residents residing in those communities with a total of 428 households. 71% of those people had legal status. 6% were undocumented, and 23% were unknown. So it is unknown where the current administration's own survey. I just hope that what we have here is not duplicating efforts in order to progress, but that we are building on what has gone before in order to be successful and effective. That's all I'll say about that for now. Next in the political review, Miles LaRota, the state minister in the office of the prime minister, who has responsibility for National Insurance Board, said that if there is no increase in the National Insurance Board contribution this year, the National Insurance Fund would lose $95 million. LaRota said his intention is not to shock Bahamians, but that there are certain realities facing the Social Security Fund. Now, before we continue this story and move on to the next portion of the show, we have recently decided that we would take phone calls. Of course, we've always taken text messages. We haven't usually been a phone-in show, but we've decided that whatever value can be added to the show by taking those phone calls, that we would do so. And my producer is informing me that there is so Paula, you're live on the political review. Paula, are you still there? I'm not hearing anything. Caller, are you still there? No. All right. So yeah, if they call back while you, thank you very much for the heads up. I appreciate it. So getting back to this NIB story, LaRota said that the looming $95 million loss is not sustainable, and he lamented the prevalence of armchair quarterbacking. According to the minister, these are the facts. The National Insurance Board would pay out $27 million every month in pensions. The board is collecting $23 million. That's a shortfall of $4 million a month, which over the course of the year is a $48 million shortfall. That doesn't even consider the industrial benefits and other benefits that are being paid out. LaRota noted that some of the issues national insurance are not things that anyone can be blamed for. People are living longer, and those longer lived people are collecting pension benefits. What that means is that they can be collecting pension for as much as 20 years when the fund's initial estimation was that people would be collecting pension benefits for 10 to 12 years. LaRota also pointed out that in the nearly 50 years since NIB was established, it's only had one increase, which was in 2010, when the rate was increased from 8.8% to 9.8%. He pointed out that the ceiling for contributions was raised from $400 to $700 plus, and added that if NIB in 2016, that is for the past 7 years, even the cash assets of the board must come under pressure because the government cannot subsidize the National Insurance Fund. LaRota pointed out that this month, around 44,000 people are collecting some form of pension benefits. That's just pension. That doesn't include people collecting disability and other benefits. Now, as we've reported on the show, the 11th actuarial valuation of the National Insurance Board of the Bahamas, as at December 31st, 2018, reported that the total annual expenditures have been higher than annual income since 2016, which means that the fund's reserve is being used to administrative responses. What the review said was that under the current parameters, that is, with no change, the reserve for the pensions branch would be exhausted in 2028. That's 1 year earlier than in the previous actuarial review. Immediate action is needed to restore not only the long-term financial sustainability of the scheme as a whole, but more importantly, in the short term. I want to say that I want people to hear what the report is saying. And to be clear, this is a report completed by the Actuarial Services Unit of the International Labor Office, right? This is not a political report. To a political party, not even a national report. It's an international body that has no dog in the race. Under the current parameters, with no change, the reserve for the pensions branch will be exhausted in 2028. What that means, folks, is that if we do not make the appropriate changes right now, after 2028, you ain't getting no pension from NIB. Are you listening? Is the government listening? You, as the voter, the person who's been paying into the NIB fund since you started work in this country, are you listening? You better go find your MP and tell them that something has to be done. The required contribution rate to pay all expenditures of all branches over the next 60 years, according to the ILO's Actuarial Services Unit, is 22.55%. The current rate is 9.8%. At the current rate, the pensions branch will be exhausted in 2028. In order to get to a level of sustainability for the next 60 years, the current rate has to be more than doubled. Of course, higher unemployment benefits paid in 2020 due to the severe contraction of the economy because of the COVID-19 pandemic increased to 23.5% from 2019 to 2023. An increase in the contribution rate by 2% every 2 years, starting in and ending on July 1 of 2036, would have restored the short-term and medium-term financial sustainability scheme. You and I know there was no contribution rate increase. They are contemplating such an increase. And the Nassau Guardian reported recently that the cabinet had approved a rate increase of, I think it was 1.5% or something along those lines, which was supposed to take effect in July. But Prime Minister Philip Brave Davis has suggested just on Friday past that a final decision had not yet been made. I'm going to quote the Prime Minister here. He told reporters, and I quote, "I continue to say that I'm going to try to resist putting more burden working class. Yes, we have looked at the matter. We understand that we have to do something. and we are trying to identify exactly what we do. Increasing the rate is one of the options that we are looking into. LaRota said this week that the government is looking at various recommendations made by the board and executives of NIB, but he didn't go into details in that regard. And as of this broadcast, our understanding is that there will in fact be no increase this year. What that means to all of us calculus, we'll have to stay vigilant so that we can see what is coming. But folks, this NIB thing is not a joke. It's not politics. It's about governance. Find your MP. Tell them that something drastic needs to be done. This is not about poor or working class. It is wrong to frame this as putting a burden on the poor. This is about ensuring that the most vulnerable people in our community have a social safety net, that at the end of their work life, they have a guarantee of at least some income, that in the event that they are injured or unemployable for some reason, that there is a backstop that will provide them with some kind of security. This isn't about the poor and the working class. It's about all of us. And I think that if there is one thing that gets done under Davis's watch, it has to be this NIB thing. That's my thoughts, anyway. So next in the political review, I got a couple of stories under the radar. Things that I thought should have gotten a lot more press than they got over the course of the week. But I also have a really great guest that I want to get to. So what I'm going to do, Wally. We want to take a break now, and then when we come back, we'll just go straight to the interview with our guest. Is that okay? Can we do that? When we come back, folks, on the political review, we will introduce our guest and have what I think is going to be a great an enlightening conversation. So stay with us. We'll be right back on the political review. Okay, apparently I'm on my own on that. So good. That means I do have some time to get to at least the first of these stories radar this week. And that story, the first one, is the fact that agriculture, marine resources, and family, I think that should be Family Island Affairs Minister Clay Sweeting, says that the government hopes to reduce imports, food imports in particular, by 25% by the year 2025. Now, during a press conference this week, Sweeting, where he reported on discussions with the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, Sweeting said that the partnership with the FAO would aid in developing agriculture and food systems in the Bahamas, noting the government's efforts towards creating a national agricultural policy. Sweeney said the Davis administration aspects of that and how the sector could further develop in regard to legislation, regulations, foreign policy, as well as domestic investment in agri-food systems. And while the minister claimed to be excited about this, one cannot help but wonder whether none of the previous administrations had created a national agricultural policy. In fact, we are aware that there are already such documents. So once again, here we go. Start from scratch so you could own it. Come on, man. Time for that over, right? Please. Meanwhile, Minister Sweeting said the hope is to reach that 25% reduction by developing and modernizing agri-food system. Food accessibility in the country has become an ongoing challenge due to inflation and high cost of living. The high cost of food has made it much more challenging for people to sustain a healthy diet. Sweeting acknowledged that the industry is aiming to expand local production that would be set at an affordable price. He said officials are launching an initiative in the next few days that would assist in expanding a niche in the market that would allow more affordability. We look forward to seeing what that initiative is, in fact, and I encourage you as members of the community to be paying special attention. The minister said that in recent times, more young people have become interested in school programs surrounding agriculture and fisheries, but he noted that there are still more participants needed in the industry. So we're looking forward to seeing what that new agricultural policy will be. We want to see what this new initiative is. We absolutely support the development and modernization of agribusiness opportunities here in the Bahamas. And we want to see how the minister and the administration are tackling this very important issue. And in our second story under the radar, Julian Rowe, BAF Financial's managing director and a member of the Bahamas Insurance Association, this week asserted that Bahamian consumers would undoubtedly see increased cost of services at pharmacies and other places due to the new interpretation of the Value Added Tax Act regarding remittance on medical insurance and healthcare services. Spoke at a Rotary Club of West Nassau meeting about the changes in the treatment of VAT imposed by the Department of Inland Revenue, or DIR, and the Ministry of Finance starting on April 1st. And those changes are in relation to insurers needing to remit VAT on their premiums, as well as for other medical services, such as hospitalization, doctor's visits, purchase of medication, therapy, and other services. Rowe said that these VAT changes will require changes in the systems at the point of payment for service providers throughout the country. He said this means that when you walk into your pharmacy, they need to be charging you differently. Everybody's got a computer system, and all of them need to be changed. And when that happens over a doctor's hospital, or all those changes again will need to take place. And those changes in systems is another thing that will undoubtedly, according to Mr. Rowe, increase the cost of services. What was once a simple process of charging a copay to someone with insurance will now involve charging VAT on services, which in some cases have yet to even be determined. Rowe said the previous statements made by the BIA in response to the issue are just the start of an education campaign it plans in order to accurately inform its clients of the changes that will be taking place, and not a bid to change the government's mind on the issue. In a statement released last month, the Ministry of Finance accused the BIA of seeking to politicize a technical issue while missing the real concerns of the Bahamian public through its framing of the issue. Roll addressed that accusation and said that he'd like to stress that the change in interpretation, and he said it's not an insurance industry issue, even though the Department of Inland Revenue sought to anchor this issue in insurance. He says that this is an issue for individuals receiving service under a medical insurance policy, as they will now have to settle the entire VAT portion of their bill for all medical and related services. The change in interpretation does not make any more money for insurers. The numbers based on this new method specifically impact clients and increase cost of healthcare. From an earlier story, a texter asks, do the workers at NIB get paid from NIB or the government? I'm pretty sure they get paid by the government. So we're going to take a short break here, folks. When we come back, we'll worry. We'll have hopefully that interview that I promised you. I'm looking forward to it. So it should be a lot of fun. All right. Thank you, folks. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Political Review with me and your host, K. Quincy Parker. John Lee Wally Ferguson is riding the boards for us today, doing a stellar job as usual. We'll be right back.
To inflation, soaring energy prices, and global tensions pose to the Caribbean. Join international experts, local professionals, and policymakers at the 9th annual RF Economic Outlook. Be part of the conversation on March 14th by reserving your seat today at rfbeo.com. RFEO 2023 is proudly sponsored by RF Bank and Trust, Alive Doctors Hospital, Fidelity Bank, J.S. Johnson, PwC, and The Tribune.
Wednesday, March 8th, 2023 is International Women's Day, a day celebrated globally as a focal point in the women's rights movement, bringing attention to issues such as gender equality, reproductive rights, and violence and abuse against women. Equity isn't just a nice to have, it's a must have. A focus on gender equity needs to be a part of every society's DNA, and it's critical to understand the difference between equity and equality. Guardian Media wants all Bahamians to truly embrace equity. It's not just something we should say, not something to just write about. It's something we need to think about, know, and embrace. It's what we should believe in, unconditionally. This International Women's Day, Guardian Media wants you and your company to embrace equity. Guardian Media wants you to celebrate the women in your organization this International Women's Day by placing them in an ad in our International Women's Day supplement. For more information, call 302-2300, 302-2300, or call your account executive. International Women's Day, Wednesday, March 8th, 2023. Embrace equity.
Ready to step into the future? From your front door to the backyard and everywhere in between. See and speak to whoever's there with Ring Video doorbells and security cameras now available at Alive. Protect what matters most, all from one easy app. Available in your Google or Apple Play Store. Visit bealive.com/ring to learn more. We are Alive.
It's here, my Salomon Smart Rewards, the ultimate loyalty rewards program. At Salomon's, Fresh Market, or Exuma Markets, start earning smart rewards every time you shop on every item you purchase. Every dollar you spend will earn you one smart rewards point, and points are redeemable in all participating locations. Getting started is quick and easy. Earn smart rewards every time you shop at Salomon's, Fresh Market, or Exuma Markets.
Boy, why you look so mashed up, like clothes at the washer?
No, boy, just a hard day, boy.
Hard day? What happened? The breakfast lady ran out of tuna and gritsy.
We need to start joking about everything, you know. This serious, boy. This real serious, boy.
Boy, what's serious? Tell me.
All right, well, today, boss gave us boy one big, big contract. And nobody else get a chance and nobody say nothing.
Boy, you know that ain't right. You know government contracts ain't supposed to go that way.
Yeah, but nobody saying nothing. Boss man just tell people to sign the papers. Then he sent me to meet his boy downtown.
Tell somebody, you need to become a whistleblower.
You know I's a real man, but I never blow no whistle. I be drunk all my life in Junkano.
No way. A whistleblower is someone who tells people what they see when they see something wrong happening at work.
But I ain't no whistleblower, and I ain't no snitch. I still wait there, you know.
Boy, ain't nobody gonna know it's you. All you gotta do is call Crime Stoppers, or you could text them from inside the Crack Crime Bahamas app. They don't ask about you, and your call goes straight through to Miami, so nobody know you is. And if you text, your message get mixed up like Kong Salad.
Call 328-8477 from Nassau, or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM.
Joining us on this, the 19th of February, year of our Lord, 2023. And we come now to our top story, political review, which of course it has to be the CARICOM, the 44th regular meeting of the Conference of Heads of Government. The Caribbean community was held here in Nassau over the last week. And the chair of the conference was our Prime Minister, Right Honorable Philip Davis. And the heads of government discussed a number of crucial issues during their multi-day sit-down. And I want to go through some of the more important ones. Well, they were all important, but some of the ones with more relevance to us here in the Bahamas. And the first, of course, would have been the issue of COVID-19 and other emerging health issues. So at this meeting, the heads receive an update from the Caribbean Public Health Agency, which emphasized the need for a comprehensive response to COVID-19, Mpox, which is the renamed monkeypox, and other regional health security threats. And the reason that I thought this was relevant particularly is because, yeah, we may not have had much of an Mpox scare, but in the region, they're dealing with the re-emerging threat of Zika and the ongoing threat of dengue, as well as other vector-borne diseases. One of the big points on COVID-19 and health issues was the low receipt of surveillance data from member states, which could stymie early detection and responses to threats in the region. And states were urged to remain vigilant and to continue to carry out active surveillance and promote the use of established prevention and control guidelines to curb further spread of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. I think that that is a vital point that they make, because as we are moving past the early stages of dealing with this pandemic, the fact is there are so many of us who are, frankly speaking, almost behaving as if COVID-19 doesn't exist anymore. And in my own family, my daughter is in college in Boston, and she got COVID for the first time when she was in the U.S. Because she was got a roommate, and that's what happens, right? But it just reminded me that the COVID-19 pandemic is ongoing, and that even though we are successfully open as an economy again, even though businesses are relaxing the control measures and prevention guidelines, and it makes it feel like you can go back out and do things, we still have a need for care, consideration, and concern, because the COVID-19 virus is not going anywhere. It has not been ended. It has been largely controlled, but even that is a tenuous control at best. So I fully support the urging of CARICOM states to remain vigilant and continue to carry out active surveillance to promote the use of established prevention and control guidelines to curb further spread of COVID-19. The heads agreed to support CARPA's vaccine campaign to launch improved COVID-19 vaccination levels and the regular expanded program of immunization activities. CARPA is the Caribbean Public Health Agency, and it's established by CARICOM leaders in July 2011, began operations in 2013. Also under the banner of health, they talked this week about the establishment of the World Bank, establishment by the World Bank of its pandemic fund, which will finance critical investments to strengthen pandemic prevention, preparedness, capacities at national, regional, and global levels with a focus on low and middle income countries. Member states were encouraged strongly to submit expressions of interest to access the fund in the first round of the process. Now, I don't know how that is going to affect the Bahamas, because of course, we have been long wrestling with the choice by some of the more developed funding nations to designate the Bahamas a high income country because of our gross national product. But that's something that Prime Minister Christie argued vehemently against. And I think this is an instance in which we see the importance of how the multilateral funding infrastructure chooses to designate a small open economy like ours. And finally, in the heads of government expressed concern at the continuing prevalence of chronic non-communicable diseases and stressed the importance of sustained evidence to address what we usually call senses. And that's an issue that we in the Bahamas have had to deal with for a while, and it's something that I don't know if we've really ever taken it as seriously as I think we should. So here's some of the things that I think we should be aware of, right? A list for the purposes of our paying of attention. Here are some of the chronic conditions that we are referring to when we talk about chronic non-communicable diseases. Things like cardiovascular disease, cardiomyopathy, endomyocardial fibrosis, cancer, particularly bladder cancer and bile duct carcinoma and whatever, gastrointestinal and liver diseases like inflammatory bowel disease or intestinal and liver fibrosis, chronic renal disease that would include renal failure. Then there are things in the blood area like anemia and so on and so forth, right? These are diseases that are afflicting so many of us, and we consider them, obviously chronic respiratory conditions as well, hypertension and asthma and edema and these things. I remember when Dr. Minnis was Minister of Health, and he made a big deal about citizens and the government having a policy of trying to do something to attack citizens and the prevalence of citizens in the Bahamas. It was Healthy Bahamas, and there were moves to deal with what children eat in the schools, the public feeding program, and those sorts of things. And it comes up again when we consider the recent arguments over what goes in the breadbasket, right? Those things that that should be the most affordable things in the country. And the fact is they're often called lifestyle diseases because they're not generally, well, I'm not a health professional, so I'm not a professional, but they're referred to as lifestyle diseases with the intention that living your life in a certain way will reduce your susceptibility to these chronic conditions. And again, we have evidence that is racked up over decades about the prevalence of these conditions in the Bahamian society. But when you look at our ministers of public health have been focused on, outside of Minas, I don't know that I can think of a particularly aggressive minister of health taking on citizens. And it's a challenge that I would like to issue to the current minister. As I said, with regard to NIB, you know, if there's one thing that Michael Darville does as the Minister of Health in this administration, that one thing could well be to seriously move the government policy machine in such a way that we really begin to tackle chronic non-communicable diseases from a government policy standpoint, in as much as government policy influences lifestyle decisions. We can certainly make it easier. And I think that that's an important thing. And I would like to challenge the minister to move in that direction. Next, the heads of government from the Caribbean region talked about the CARICOM Single Market and Economy, CSME. And they talked about progress on the implementation of it. They agreed that the revised Treaty of Chaguaramas would be amended to provide for the regulation of mergers and acquisitions in the CSME on the basis of an approved community policy. The revised Treaty of Chaguaramas is what gave birth to the Caribbean community. That's kind of our CARICOM establishing document. Heads of government agreed that member states should complete their internal consultations and approval processes on the draft policy in order to try to get that policy approved in April. Now, the Bahamas, of course, remains outside the single market and economy, and no political administration has indicated a desire to change that stance. We could talk about why that is, but that's a definite position that we have taken as a CARICOM member state. On the issue of advancing the CARICOM agri-food systems agenda, there was a report given by the CARICOM Ministerial Task Force on Food Production and Food Security. Basically, there was a project proposed entitled Building Food Security Through Innovation, Resilience, Sustainability, and Empowerment, that was supported by the CARICOM heads of state. Guyana pledged $2 million towards financing and implementing the project. it's of note, especially given what Minister Sweeting committed to in a press conference following the meeting, that that the heads requested that that states, well, that the Secretariat accelerated efforts in the mobilization of resources towards the achievement of the 25 by 2025 initiative. And remember now, that initiative is a move by member states to reduce food imports 25% by the year 2025. And the commitment by our minister, Clay Sweeting, to reaching that objective, I think it's going to be really important to see how that that plays out from a government policy, a legislation, a government finance perspective. With regard to climate change and climate finance, you know that that was a major discussion point of the CARICOM heads of government meeting. So sorry, folks, please excuse me. Needless to say, well, I'll say it anyway, whether it's needless or not, but the heads really were severely disappointed that the 27th conference of the parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP27, held in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, did not deliver on its headline agenda of implementation, but rather it ended with only weak climate finance and mitigation outcomes. They gave the heads gave kudos to Antigua and Barbuda as chair of the Alliance of Small Island States. And it was through the work of that alliance and damage fund was established. And they welcomed that, but the heads of government also noted that what would be delivered depended on the follow through of the process to resource and access the fund. Of course, they are planning high-level political advocacy amongst major economies to encourage greater ambition to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And they also advocated for CARICOM member states to implement their nationally determined contributions and adaptation plans, as well as to support the just transitions for member states. Well, it's going to be interesting to see what our nationally determined contribution and adaptation plan looks like, given the government's continued assertion, particularly the Prime Minister's continued assertion, that we're not causing climate change, but we're suffering for it. And here, let me say that it would have been, on the one hand, quite a statement to have had this meeting virtually and point out that we are not using this kind of meeting as a way of increasing our carbon footprint. All the private planes, all the private cars, in the different caravans. This meeting had a significant carbon footprint. And it would have been, as I say, quite a statement to have foregone all of that and just had the meeting virtually. Now, I understand that, you know, heads of state need to meet in person, and there are some things that you can't do online. But to an extent, you know, I wish that there would have been some way to reduce the carbon footprint of this meeting. And especially given the vital importance that we place on emissions and how those emissions are affecting our countries. A lot of their climate change commentary really revolves around the idea of advocacy. Like, they plan to advocate for systemic approaches to debt relief for CARICOM member states in the context of unlocking new sources of finance for climate action and sustainable development, including for robust work on vulnerability indices, right? Negotiation, right? The detailed negotiation agenda in the build-up to COP28. This is why international diplomacy matters. And it's a delicate balancing act that you have to engage in, because much of this negotiation has to be done state to state. And a Zoom meeting is sometimes just not going to get it done. So you physically have to go. But by the same token, by jumping on a jet and flying to wherever, you are almost working against yourself because you're increasing your own carbon footprint. So it's a catch-22, but it's something that I think as a region, you know, we really don't have a choice. We have to go and negotiate for this, these kinds of changes in person. We have to, you know, our leaders have to look other leaders in the eye and say, you know that your country owes my country for the damage that you are doing with your industrial and your economic agenda at the expense of mine. What are you going to do about it? Be very interesting to see. They also talked about Global Tourism Resilience Day, which was recognized on February 17th, and will be recognized on that day every year now. The heads recognize the role of CARICOM countries, in particular the Bahamas and Guyana, in obtaining international consensus on the recognition of Global Tourism Resilience Day. And then a couple of special guests at the meeting, in addition to Justin Trudeau and some of the others. One of them was the president and the chairman of the African Export-Import Bank, Professor Benedict Oke Oramah. And, you know, the bank offers a wide range of services. And the heads took note of that, particularly given the bank's, and they used the phrase in their statement, complementarity, with the development goals of the Caribbean community. And they took the opportunity to thank the bank for its role in assisting member states in securing critical supplies of COVID-19 vaccines through the African Medical Supplies platform. Oh my Lord. Folks, Wally, we need to take a break. So sorry, folks. This. Show at 6 o'clock. Let's Talk Live in English with Lady T is up, and we'll be back next week with another brand new episode of the Political Review. Until then, God bless, and we'll see you later. Take care.